I'm Alan Little, and this is Turkey, the New Ottomans, a three-part series for the BBC World Service, looking at how Turkey is redefining its place in the world. I began making this series just as a small group of environmentalists was beginning a protest to stop the removal of trees from Gezi Park, one of the few remaining green spaces in the crowded, crashing turmoil of central Istanbul. It is striking now how self-confident Turkey's governing party, the AKP, sounded then. They did not see the anger that was building among so many of their own people. They genuinely believed that they had brought real democracy to Turkey after almost a century of military-backed authoritarian rule. Listen to Prime Minister Erdogan's principal political adviser, Ibrahim Kalin, speaking to me just before the protests began about the achievements of the AKP, or AK Party, as it's also known.
I will say AK Party's vision for a pluralistic, democratic, free market economy type of Turkey found a lot of resonance with the people. I think one of the really important changes that Prime Minister Erdogan has introduced into the Turkish political life has been his ability to mobilize the most conservative segments of the Turkish society to come to terms and embrace most of these global universal values without any contradiction between people's conservative, traditional, Islamic and Turkish identity on the one hand and these new global values such as democracy, human rights on the other.
How complacent, how out of touch that sounds now. Who knew back then that so many Turks saw in the growing self-confidence of the AKP something sinister? On the 31st of May, police moved in to break up that initial demonstration. Within hours, hundreds of thousands had joined the protests.
Even now, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the rioting is still going on. And the people around me are not some extremist hardcore. These are ordinary members of society, educated, mainly middle class.
In Turkey's century-long journey to democracy, the forces of secular modernity and religious conservatism have repeatedly collided. In this programme, I'll be setting today's events against a longer history, reaching to the end of the Ottoman Empire after the First World War, plotting the rise of Turkey's Islamists and their attempt to pursue a religiously inspired political agenda within a secular republic. For Turkey is unique. It has a religiously conservative government that is passionately committed to joining the EU, that has embraced global free market economics and brought unprecedented prosperity, doubling the size of Turkey's economy in a decade. But they came to clash with a new and rising class of young Turks that very success had created.
I live in this neighborhood for more than a decade, and this park is the only green area near my house. But at this moment, after all these things and the way everything has started, it's not only about protecting the park. On the third day of the demonstrations, in around 5 o'clock in the morning, I have been gassed in my bedroom. The police had followed the protesters up to the very residential areas, and they have gassed the residents in there while they were sleeping their beds. That really provoked me. It's not about trees anymore. It's also important that we have a more participatory democracy and more transparent government.
The demonstrators' common cause was hostility to a government that they believed had begun to intrude into their private lives and liberties.
The principal value is personal liberty, and that's really very important.
Gulbana Azcan of Royal Holloway College in London.
Freedom of dressing as you like, especially for women, having the control over your body, enjoying a glass of beer in a hot summer day, judging whether you will have abortion or not, judging whether you will have one or two children, not like what the Prime Minister suggests, three.
When the AKP came to power in 2002, they represented a radical break with Turkey's past. For almost a century, the country had been ruled by an authoritarian, though secular, regime backed by the army. The military frequently intervened. Turkey's 20th century is punctuated by military coups. Critics of the regime, especially Islamists, were often jailed or hanged. This quasi-military state was the nature of the Turkish Republic, founded on the ruins of the Ottoman Empire in the 1920s by the man still revered as the father of the nation, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Despite its beauty, despite its architectural wonders, the founders of the Turkish Republic wanted to turn their backs on this teeming metropolis of Istanbul. They associated it with all the centuries of decline and collapse in the late Ottoman period. They closed the Sharia courts, they imported a whole legal code from the Swiss Republic. They scrapped the Arabic alphabet and replaced it with Latin script. They even legislated what people could wear, banning the wearing of the fez, which they saw as a symbol of Eastern ignorance and darkness. The founders of the Turkish Republic were year zero men. They wanted to wipe the slate clean and start again, as though all the centuries of Ottoman experience had never happened.
They thought about it as a yoke over the Turkish nation. These are the words that were used.
Elgin Alkari of Şehir University.
In the textbook, history textbooks, very few pages, 10 pages, 20 pages, covering the Ottoman past, as opposed to, say, the Central Asian past, or even Renaissance in Europe.
Basically, they wanted to forget it.
They wanted to forget it. They also used it as some kind of excuse. You blame the Ottoman past to answer why Turks were not as much progressed as, say, Western European countries.
In the Atatürk Republic, religion was removed from the nation's public discourse. In its race to de-Ottomanize, the new Turkish nation-state would be aggressively secular.
Ottomans and Islam go hand in hand. Islam was wiped out of the public space. There's this very famous speech by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. In that speech, he says, the Turks bore the burden of all the things that the Ottomans did, so it was time to take our own sovereignty. And that became more or less the backbone of the narrative.
The Atatürk Republic was built on a rewriting of Turkey's past. In the 1920s, the new regime reimagined for Turkey a Western identity. They cut their country off from its Arab neighbours and recast it as a modern European nation-state. It was an astonishingly successful root-and-branch refashioning. The Ottoman past was quietly jettisoned. I'm standing in front of a broad archway beneath a vast, decorated marble awning. From here, generations of Ottoman sultans looked across a shining blue sea to Christian Europe, and they had all the might of the Muslim East at their backs. Baba Iyali, for the last century, has housed a hidden, dormant treasure, the archives of the Ottoman imperial story, 150 million documents chronicling one of the most powerful empires in human history. It's a history the founders of the Turkish Republic wanted to forget. For decades, the archive was uncatalogued and access to it highly restricted.
The first time I went to the Ottoman archives was in 1996.
Abdulhamit Kismi, also of Şehir University in Istanbul, was brought up in Germany at a time when showing an interest in Ottoman history was almost taboo in Turkey.
It was very bureaucratic, and first you have to be allowed to get into the archives, and this took a month. And you couldn't work on some topics. At the beginning of my PhD, I wanted to work on the Ottoman ulema, on this religious elite of the Ottoman Empire. And some friends told me that you better don't do this because Woods might disturb some professors.
Because it would make you a suspect figure, would it?
Yeah, a suspect figure. You would be labeled as Islamist. But now there is no such problem. I mean, you can work whatever you want. The Sharia, the Islamic law of the Ottoman Empire.
It's not considered dangerous anymore.
No, not dangerous anymore, yeah.
But it was dangerous in the 1980s. Kismi's veteran colleague, the historian Engin Alkari, was then a young lecturer in Istanbul, a pious Muslim who criticized the way children were taught history.
I was put on trial for making a speech. It was a big meeting, international meeting. I said, I saw them textbooks used in middle schools. They have covers, slanted-eyed Turks with sword in their hands. Look, there are so many, half of this room, maybe more than half, are Turks and from Turkey. How many of you have slanted eyes like this? This is not Ottoman history. This is not Turkish history.
They orientalized their own past.
Exactly. 1983, I was kicked out of my position. I got so angry because I did nothing wrong. I mean, you have children, you have family to take care of.
Al-Khari was forced into exile, eventually finding work in the United States. But he stayed in touch with a generation of his students who, like him, were devout Muslims and who began to assert what they saw as their democratic right to be religiously inspired cultural conservatives and to argue for Islamic values in public life. The journalist Nureyn Mert knew many of these young Islamists and remembers the discrimination they faced in Turkey's prestigious Western-oriented universities, like Boğaziçi in Istanbul.
It was an ex-American college, and it was a very privileged place. And it was the ultimate Western, you know, secular life. And at the time, I mean, despite the fact that all scholars were pretending to be extremely, you know, liberal and democrat and all that, there was no place for conservatives. I mean, by conservative, I mean those who are praying 5 times, for instance. It was something outrageous. I was particularly interested in these people, but I mean, there was visible boundary. Most people, they didn't even, you know, thought of about them. You know, they were thought of coming from, you know, I don't know, backwardness or whatever.
Nureyn Mert in the 1980s and 90s objected to this exclusion of religious conservatives because she believed it discriminated against poorer, less westernized Turks, among whom religious adherence persisted. The secularism of the Ataturk state, known as Kemalism, made observant Muslims, she believed, second-class citizens in their own country. Prime Minister Erdogan's political adviser, Ibrahim Kalin.
Kemalism as an ideology turned out to be a totalitarian ideology, close to the rest of the world, even though in its roots it claims to be pro-Western, pro-European, etc. It proposed a closed system, placed the state at the center of Turkish life rather than the nation, rather than the people or the individual, primarily endorsed military tutelage as the vanguard of the republic. All of these ideas obviously were impossible to uphold in the 21st century.
The AKP, the Justice and Development Party, emerged as a challenge to the authoritarianism of the state. The journalist Nureyn Mert, like many of this summer's protesters in Taksim Square, was initially sympathetic. But she believes that once in power, the AKP would eventually adopt the same repressive techniques they had once fought against. The old freedom fighters, once in power themselves, would use the same coercive state apparatus against their own opponents.
In the mind of all these people, democracy meant majority rule. They are coming from this right-wing political tradition. And in their mind, I mean, the state is sacred. It turned to be like, you know, switching from one authoritarian understanding of politics to another.
This is the paradox of Erdogan's Turkey. It is a democracy. The government is elected, and the AKP would probably win again if there were an election tomorrow. But it is an illiberal democracy, one in which majority rule is not matched by secure minority rights. The ruling party is accused of behaving as though victory at the ballot box legitimizes almost anything. İstar Gözaydın is professor of law and politics at Doğuş University.
It's a historical thing, actually, coming from the Ottoman times. It's a centralized, absolutist kind of understanding of having a majority ruling the others.
Erdogan was himself a victim of this authoritarianism. He spent 4 months in jail under the old regime for publicly reciting a poem that was perceived to be Islamist. So when he came to power in 2002, his supporters heralded a new era of human rights and freedom. The AKP, despite its Islamist agenda, was passionate about Turkey's European future. It carried out human rights reforms to comply with EU standards. It also took on Turkey's powerful military to make the army properly accountable to elected civilian authority.
A senior Pentagon official has this evening confirmed that the United States has abandoned the idea of sending its 4th Infantry Division through Turkey.
So as a senior defense official put it to me, the many ships that have been bobbing around in the eastern Mediterranean are now heading south, heading for the Persian Gulf, clearly on their way to Kuwait.
March 2003 was a pivotal moment. As it prepared to invade Iraq, the United States was still planning to base tens of thousands of troops in eastern Turkey to enter Iraq from the north. Erdogan himself supported the plan. But to the shock of many in Turkey, Parliament voted against it.
We were all very much surprised. It was taken for granted that it would pass because the government was in favor. It was known that the chief of staff was in favor.
It was a moment that signaled something profound about the new Turkey. The army had been subordinated to civilian authority. Sami Cohen is a political analyst at Milliyet newspaper.
It was accepted as an expression of democracy. Here, Parliament had the guts to say no in spite of the will of the generals. Also, you had the civilian government under Erdogan who respected this decision, and he said, this is our policy.
And there's a second pivotal moment, the moment when Turkey's aspiration to join the EU stalled in 2005, mainly because of opposition in France and Germany. Turkish public opinion had strongly favoured full membership. The prospect of joining had provided a powerful impetus to democratic reform in Turkey. Public opinion now turned away from Europe, and the pressure on Turkey's government to reform further diminished rapidly. Turkey began to look beyond Europe, to strengthen its links with the Arab world, with Asia and Africa. Again, the AKP sought to revive some of the spirit of the lost Ottoman past. It began to draw the lands of the old empire like a shawl around its shoulders. The AKP's Ibrahim Kalin again.
For a long time, the Turkish modernizers believed that Turkey's cultural history was a baggage that had to be jettisoned. Turkey's geography was a problem. That is, you know, you are connected to the Middle Eastern countries, all trouble spots in the world, etc. That was the perception. What changed again was the mentality that we can in fact turn our historical heritage as well as geographic location into a strategic asset. So we began to work on this, lifting visas, by developing economic relations, expanding our trade routes, reconnecting with the people in the Middle East, in North Africa, in the Black Sea region, even in Russia, in Ukraine, in the Balkans, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, and you know, many other parts of the world.
Turkey also strengthened its relations with the autonomous Kurdish region that had grown up in northern Iraq after the first Gulf War of 1991. Under Erdogan, Turkish businesses thrived there, especially in construction and trade. That helped open the door to something new in Turkish politics: the prospect of a peace settlement with Turkey's own Kurdish minority, with whom the Turkish state had been at war for decades. For the old secular Ataturk Republican elite, a deal with Kurdish separatists was tantamount to treason, but Erdogan pursued it. Sami Cohen.
Turkish media never referred to Kurds as Kurds, Mountain Turks.
Mountain Turks.
Others, yeah. Today, Turks are able to talk about the Kurdish issue. That's another thing, you know, and I think that where we are now is very significant.
And what is it about the AKP and Erdogan that has made it possible for Turkey to open that door for the first time in its century-long history?
Yeah. This government is very self-confident of the achievements that have been done in the last few years. The economy is doing well. Turkey's a regional actor. But it has still a major handicap, and that is the Kurdish problem at home. The leadership in the AKP has realized if it really wants to succeed, it has to put its own house in order.
But it's not just a change of policy, is it? It's, in a sense, it's redefining what Turkey is. It's redefining the nature of the republic.
Yeah. It's absolutely, you're right. Yes, the historic process has started. It cannot be stopped.
Earlier this year, Erdogan seemed on the verge of a historic deal that would end the armed conflict and lead to the release of the jailed Kurdish leader, Abdullah Öcalan. Something unthinkable until very recently. This extraordinary achievement is itself now threatened by Erdogan's response to the popular protests. For many Turks now question his motives in seeking peace with the Kurds. Many believe it's driven by Erdogan's stated desire to change the constitution to create a strong executive presidency, with himself as all-powerful president. Gulbana Azcan.
Why did the government wait for 10 years to do this? The agenda is believed to be that in order to become the president and change the constitution to a presidential regime, the AK Party and Erdogan needed the support of the Kurds. So unfortunately, if we look at the issues in a cynical manner, this is not really a wholeheartedly supported, transparent and well-debated peace deal. It's a deal between Mr. Öcalan and Mr. Erdogan.
His response to the protests has revealed starkly the authoritarian impulses that drive Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It is, for Nure Mert, a betrayal of the great democratizing potential that his election in 2002 represented. She had lost her academic job under the old regime because she had dared to criticize the government. In 2002, she had high hopes.
Only after this government came to power, I could go back to my university post. But then things started to change and they start to feel more powerful in their second term. Their insistence on electing party member as a president, I start to feel concerned about them becoming more and more authoritarian.
She now began to criticize Erdogan's government in the newspapers and on television. Erdogan, stung by the defection of a former supporter, turned his personal wrath on her. In a public statement, he added a prefix to her surname, calling her Namert.
My surname is Mert, means brave, trustable. If you reverse it by putting Na in the beginning, it becomes just the opposite. The negative implies treason.
And were you frightened?
At the time, I was frightened about public anger. There are prices to pay for my political position. But after all, this is a very nationalist country. So you just, you know, go into hiding. I mean, you don't appear on public much. The real price turned to be my TV program, which is the most popular political program, debate program, is cancelled.
Erdogan was now interpreting any attack on his government as an attack on Turkey itself. His government did not only tame the political power of the army, a positive development in a liberal democracy, it also tamed the media. Turkey has more journalists in prison, even than China. Gulbana Azcan.
They have been disciplined. I would call it the biggest purge of the media in recent history of the country. So media actually now uses a self-censorship process. Because many journalists, among them actually some of my old classmates, in private conversations explain that whenever they write anything critical of government or ministers or the party, the editors get phone calls from the ministers and they receive threatening messages that they may lose their jobs because of this pressure coming from the government.
In the same spirit, the Taksim Square protesters are denounced by Erdogan as terrorists and looters.
Many people who have been sympathetic to AK Party were disturbed by those expressions, and Erdogan lost a lot of credibility among many people, well-educated as well as the ordinary people.
The other thing that it's easy to forget is that it's actually very dangerous to do this in Turkey, isn't it? Because Turkey has some of the strongest anti-terror laws in the world.
They have taken a lot of risks and there is now a clampdown. So doctors are being arrested for helping the wounded. Lawyers have been arrested. This shows how determined people are to stand up and get together. And they did win, in my view, by showing the power of togetherness.
Who are the people on Turkey's streets taking these extraordinary risks? They're not the old Atatürk-era establishment. They are mostly young, well-educated, urbanized. Most have never been politically active before. They're a new class in Turkish society, created by the very economic success that has made Erdogan so electable. The AKP did not understand what it had created. It made the mistake of assuming that this rising new demographic group would be satisfied with prosperity alone. It is not so. İstar Gözaydın.
After the coup d'etat of 1980, there has been a generation. Almost everybody was thinking that those youngsters are not politicized in any way. They're sort of consumers and not interested in political affairs, etc. This showed how wrong this idea is. There are lots of people who are really concerned about their personal rights in this country.
Since the fall of the Ottoman Empire, Turkey has had a century-long struggle between conceptions of modernity and conservatism. Erdogan has asserted the supremacy of his own religiously inspired ideology. But it has collided with a powerful new force in the world, the voice of an emerging global middle class that is now asserting itself in the rising economies and the new democracies. That class wants more than the prosperity delivered by global capitalism. It wants its governing elites to be accountable and to honour the rights and liberties of individual citizens. Turkey's democracy is strengthened by what has happened in Gezi Park this summer. Turkey, the New Ottomans, was presented by me, Alan Little, and produced for the BBC World Service by Jane Beresford. The researcher was Dorian Jones. Next week, Turkey's role in the Arab Spring. Come.